Welcome to Security Wire Weekly, the CertSecurity.com podcast for October 20th, 2010. In this edition, we'll talk with two experts on the Stuxnet Trojan. We talked to a reverse engineer at a defense contractor about the threat it poses.
Pretty impressive what they did, I have to admit. The things behind it, whoever did it, is pretty impressive. Yeah. They know what they're doing.
Then Metasploit creator H.D. Moore of Rapid7 joins us.
Types of vulnerabilities that were used and combined to make that attack work would all require folks with very strong backgrounds in each area, but not necessarily the same area. So really looks like it was a large group effort to make that happen.
Well, thanks for joining me. I'm Rob Westervelt. Security experts have been downright giddy about the Stuxnet Trojan. They say it's an exciting and scary piece of malware. Stuxnet uses advanced coding. It uses 4 zero-day vulnerabilities, and it has the ability to seek out a specific piece of software and inject itself into Siemens programmable logic controllers. Those are the critical systems that maintain power plants and other facilities and make sure that they run smoothly. Well, up first, we talk to a reverse engineer at a U.S. defense contractor. He gives us his thoughts on the sophistication of newer malware and what Stuxnet poses.
So what's your name and industry?
Alexander Hage.
And you're in the defense industry?
Mm-hmm. A lot of the things that actually are real issues are just 0 days with vendors, things that don't actually get patched quickly, stuff like that. You always have the user. That's always going to be one issue. I mean, unless you have like really good education for the users, you're always going to get exploited. I mean, it's pretty easy just to double click an executable, even though, you know, it's supposedly like a big botnet and everyone detects it, but a lot of the times these things have been recompiled undetected. So that's one of my main concerns, actually.
What's your take on Stuxnet?
I actually looked at the code about 4 or 5 days ago. It's fascinating. I don't really think much of the first like layers of it through that. It's like a UPX DLL and stuff like that. But the things behind it, whoever did it, is pretty impressive. Yeah. They know what they're doing.
Do you think we're going to see more malware like that? You know, yeah. Using 4 zero-day vulnerabilities and
It's money. That's what it comes down to. I mean, like if people have the investments for it and actually can finance it, yeah. I mean. I'm just thinking about like browsers, you know, it's you get a vulnerability in that and you hit a bunch of web servers and you get a lot of installs, which makes a lot more money. So, I mean, it's pretty impressive what they did, I have to admit.
As a reverse engineer, whenever we go to a conference, we hear about, malware is getting more sophisticated and what have you.
Yeah.
Is malware getting more sophisticated?
I mean, I've actually been in the malware industry for about 5 years. I started originally when, like, you know, adware and problems were, like, coming around. So it's definitely getting more sophisticated. The code's getting more complex. They use more obfuscation techniques. But, I mean, I would say it's just getting more complex just because it's moving more into actually real development. You know, it's... I hate to say it, they probably had their own project managers. You know, when you're pulling in a couple $100,000, you know, every 6 months due to some code that you wrote, you're going to make sure it's developed well. So it's going to get more sophisticated. And I mean, I've actually talked to people where they actually had detection of an executable. 4 hours later, it was undetected. You went and downloaded another executable. It wouldn't have been detected by the antivirus. So, I mean, they're putting a big amount into it in the development aspect.
What do you think the future holds? Is it going to continue to be a cat and mouse game?
Yeah, it always will be. That's security. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's always going to be an issue. You know, there's a lot of talk about moving more towards hardware and everything like that, but it's always cat and mouse. It's just like digital rights management or any type of thing like that. Security through obfuscation only works so much.
Do you think we'll ever get to the point where end users will be educated enough, to kind of pick out the phishing threats and what have you?
Yeah, I mean, in a general sense, It depends on the corporation, how they're actually much they're going to invest on actually telling the people how to work with these things, actually identifying. Most people aren't going to go out and find the education themselves because it's not really applicable to their daily life.
And you think education is helpful? I mean, there's kind of...
Well, it's just statistics. I mean, you drop basically, it's, you know, it's kind of like any type of crime. The more educated people are, the less likely it's going to happen in a sense. So, I mean, it's just like if knowing your way around a dark alley. I mean, I hate to say it like that, but it's true. It's if you understand what you're looking for and what are actually the potentials, you're less likely for it to happen. So.
And we're seeing this explosion of mobile devices at the endpoint. Does that bother you? I mean, is that? Do you think that's a threat right now? We're hearing so much about, more and more people are using smartphones and other devices. You know, it could be the next big attack vector.
You know, there's always been, people have always talked about mobile viruses and stuff like that. But, I mean, everything comes back to statistics. It's less likely that there's going to be an attack vector on there because it's less likely people are using it. You know, it's just kind of like how Windows is always being targeted compared to Mac. You know, more people are starting to use Mac, that'll start to change. People are starting to use iPhones more, that'll start to change. It's just statistics. It's use.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, no problem. Okay.
Up next, H.D. Moore with Security Media Group Editorial Director Michael Momoso.
Hi, I'm Mike Momoso, and what follows is a conversation I had with Metasploit creator H.D. Moore, recorded just prior to the release of Metasploit Pro, the first professional iteration of the Metasploit framework. You can read about that release at searchsecurity.com. Here in this interview, H.D. talks to me about the Stuxnet worm and its eye-opening impact on critical infrastructure security. Later on, we talk about Metasploit's first anniversary since it was acquired by vulnerability management vendor Rapid7. Obviously, Stuxnet getting a lot of attention lately. What do you make of it in terms of sophistication? Is there anything unique that you haven't seen before? And if so, you know, what was it?
Stuxnet really was the first exploit that we saw worm or tool or attack or what do you want to call it that we saw that really combined that many different aspects and that many different vulnerabilities all in one package.
Mm-hmm.
So for me it was impressive because the types of vulnerabilities that were used and combined to make that attack work would all require folks with very different, very strong backgrounds in each area, but not necessarily the same area. So it really looks like it was a large group effort to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they use one vulnerability to get access through the printer, and then another vulnerability to actually get the code to execute on the printer through another undocumented mechanism. It was just kind of mind-blowing how many different vulnerabilities were used and kind of what the entire process was. And also the fact that when it was all said and done, it wasn't an aggressive, spreading worm. It wasn't like your Zeus, it wasn't your botnet.
Right.
It was designed for another specific purpose. So I think it was a good example of kind of what a moderately resourceful group can do if they put their mind to it.
I mean, we're always hearing about kind of these whispers of attacks on SCADA systems and critical infrastructure systems. Why did this one get so public? I mean, you would imagine that they'd want to keep it a little stealthy if they're after such a high-value target, if that indeed was the target.
I mean, it's probably one of two things. I mean, keep in mind, this was actually discovered back in 2009. It took almost a full year before we really started talking about it in the mainstream press, before it was really identified, before most folks in the industry really had a chance to even look at the binary and figure out what it was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they did keep it quiet for a pretty long time, considering all the different interesting bits that are part of it.
Right.
As far as why it was actually detected, I mean, your two options are either it shouldn't have been detected, so it screwed up and it spread further than it should have, or that it was intentionally detected or intentionally distributed to make a point, to show that the capabilities are there to do these types of attacks by whoever carried them out. So whether that means someone's taking credit for it privately or not, it could have been someone putting a stake in the ground saying, here's our capabilities on the cyber front, basically kind of a deterrence mechanism.
So if it is a stake in the ground, what could be the next steps? I mean, how dangerous is this as kind of like a proof of concept?
As far as whether this is a proof of concept or more dangerous, I think Stuxnet was a good example of demonstrating what the capabilities could be if they decided to go further, but not necessarily. I mean, if assume this is if someone who was intent on actually causing harm were the authors of this tool and had these capabilities, you would probably see it attacking more than just, you know, one type of PLC from Siemens. If you look at the SCADA security in general, it's so bad these days, you don't necessarily need a complicated exploit. It's just to blow up a building. And I wish I meant that jokingly, but, you know, quick search on Shodan or any of these other search engines, the inexperienced web servers will immediately find a lot of SCADA equipment that's basically on the web, unprotected, mm-hmm. Potentially has the default password, and controls things like boilers, heating elements, cooling systems, things like that. It isn't rocket science to attack SCADA systems, and most of the time you don't need a new exploit or a new attack or new vulnerability to do so. You just need a default login or a debug client for VxWorks or something else. These attacks aren't that sophisticated to start with.
So if you're an enterprise of a corporate environment, what do you take from Stuxnet as a lesson, a takeaway?
without pointing fingers at who wrote it, maybe pay your taxes, I'm not sure. It's hard to tell. It depends who takes credit for it in the long run. I think Stuxnet was a good example of someone who was able to combine multiple vectors to achieve one goal and do so in a way that took people a long time to figure out how they did it and how it all worked. I don't think most enterprises are going up against adversaries with those kinds of resources.
Right.
But there are, things like there were attacks, things like other kind of what people were calling advanced persistent threats. Use similar aspects of this. Combining a single unknown vulnerability with additional automation, evasion techniques, things like that. Those are the types of attacks we are defending against day to day. They just don't happen to be quite as sophisticated as the Stuxnet stuff that we saw.
So we're approaching the 1 year anniversary of the acquisition. Tell me about your first year under Rapid7.
Going into this relationship with Rapid7, there was a lot of trepidation about, how things would go, what would happen to the project, what would happen to the community. My biggest concerns were, if we're able to launch a commercial product, can we do that successfully? Will people accept it? Will people actually purchase it? But also, if we do that, will we lose our community and kind of lose our open source kind of foundation in the process? And I'm happy to say that I think we've actually managed to walk that line perfectly. We've got a strong product, strong sales, but we're also continuing to grow the community, continuing to improve the open source product. And a lot of it came down to kind of how we combine the two, where all of the commercial products we develop as part of Rapid7 use the open source core, and they don't use a different version of the exact same version that we distribute to our normal users as well.
What kinds of feedback did you hear from the community at first?
Initially folks were worried it turned into, I think the common analogy with Nessus was an open source project with a huge contributor base. The company went commercial after getting some funding, and then the source code eventually became closed source, and folks who were using it commercially on using the open source product commercially were basically told they need to pay at the fee if they want to continue doing so. So that was the biggest feedback we got is, whatever you do, don't do it this way because we use your product commercially. And to be honest, there aren't very many legitimate uses for Metasploit that aren't commercial.
Mm-hmm.
It's internal IG security or whether it's external security or doing consulting. It really is a product that doesn't have a strong case outside of the research and commercial work.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember at the time of the acquisition was announced that you specifically referred to Nessus as kind of the example not to do. You did kind of look at those as some of the open source cases that didn't go as well and, purposely stayed away from them.
Yeah, we think we figured it out. Basically what we banked on is that folks are willing to pay money to use a product that solves a lot of the, that basically saves them time, that makes things easier, that makes things more accessible. Even the folks who are hardcore Metasploit users today still like the commercial products because it's a product they can ask their junior admins to look at. It's a product they can have their, less expert staff actually able to use, and they trust the results are actually accurate, and they can integrate with it with the room tools they need to. So we think we've kind of found a good mix of ease of use and automation, but also without kind of alienating the rest of our advanced user community.
How about for you personally? Has this freed up more time for you to get more hands-on with work with the tool, or talk about it from that perspective?
It's definitely been a change in terms of how I work on the project. I have been able to put a lot more time in actually writing code and kind of solving the big issues. One of the challenges we had before is anytime we wanted to make a large scale change to the framework, whether it's to address a performance issue or to add a new feature, there was never really a good time for it because any change that it takes 3 or 4 weeks to implement as kind of a part-time process will leave the framework so broken in between or requires branching off, merging back in, but the overhead of kind of working on those large features is so high that we never really got a chance to tackle them. now that we have more resources available, I'm not the only person working on the core code all the time, it's actually much easier to tackle kind of large changes and really kind of move a lot faster than we did before. So for me, it's been great because all the things that have been kind of annoying me for the last 7 years of the project about, you know, I wish we could do this better, I wish we were faster at this, I wish we had support for that, we're actually able to do these things.
Is this the kind of evolution for the project that you envisioned way back when? I mean, did you ever have this kind of expectation you would end up in such a good spot, but I mean, you know, working professionally with this tool?
Not at all. I mean, this was kind of a, working on this tool was kind of a response to how I saw the security industry. So at the time, a lot of the tools that people were working on became more and more commercialized. So anything that was, any new exploit tools were starting to become pay only. A lot of the exploit developers started taking jobs at commercial companies. Basically, the free resources available for exploit developers and for folks doing pen testing with exploits were drying up left and right in 2003 when I first started working on it. So I saw this as kind of a fight back against that trend and kind of closing things up in the exploit development area. And it's surprising that we've actually now gone to a commercial stage, but are still able to provide lots of open source, free exploit resources to everybody else as well. So for me, this started off as kind of a reactionary process to the commercialization of security early on, and now it's gone commercialized, I feel like we still kind of have kept our core values of providing stuff that anybody needs it.
Yeah, it's not such a dirty word to commercialize your product anymore, is it?
That's probably the core, is that I thought commercialization would entail closing things up and making things less accessible, and I think it's actually been the opposite in this case.
I mean, you mentioned obviously you have more time and more resources. What are some of the other benefits and challenges you've encountered in the first year with the Rapid7?
Well, we didn't cut any corners when we brought on the development team. We brought on folks that either already knew the product well or were already senior developers and had a lot of experience with these types of products before. So we felt like we brought on a team that knew what they were doing from day one, that could hit the ground running. And for me, the biggest surprise was that they actually picked it up and do it. Like, I don't have to... When something's broken in the framework, it usually gets fixed before I even hear about it and see it these days. Like, whereas before, if something broke, I usually heard about it from a user, you know, when they update the tree and something's not working, and then I have to figure out the bug. And these days, things generally fix themselves. We have enough folks who are monitoring the mailing list, who are working with the community, who are actively engaged, both on the core level at Rapid7, as well as the community level now, that a lot of the fires we have used at the fight are now basically solved before they become an issue.
Must be a good feeling to have all of that behind you.
It feels like a high availability for open source development, whereas before it was kind of a single point of failure. It really feels like we've got the ability to handle the situation a lot easier now and kind of move a lot faster and be a little more flexible.
Just take me back, you know, a couple of years. What was your core, you know, quote-unquote team like, and, you know, compare it to today in terms of, you know, number of people available and so forth?
I mean, early on, I was always the person that would kind of get all the, every release that we ever cut was when I had to build and test myself. I hadn't had any help with actually building and testing release until after Rapid7 acquisition. Now, release time would take gunsmiths longer every single year. Early on, we did releases once every month or two, but there's very little testing that went into them. Things were generally, you know, broken, respawn. Towards then, 3.2 and then early 3.3 development, the project had gotten so large that just managing the testing process for each release was taking 2 weeks all by itself. And then doing the Windows side, Windows compatibility builds, was taking another week and a half on top of it. So almost a full month of work went into just being able to get a release solid and distribute it to the users. So that was the biggest challenge then, was from a team perspective, there were a lot of folks who were working on the core Metasploit framework, but they were only involved at the, you know, the feature level, the API level, the exploit level. They're working different pieces of it, but nobody was really owning the entire project in terms of making sure that the quality was there, that things test properly, that the releases were cut, that the servers were configured, that the MD5s were up, that, you know, packages were signed. All that kind of back-end administrative work basically fall on my shoulders solely until the Rapid7 acquisition.
All right, great. Well, hey, it was great talking to you today, and again, congratulations.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Mike.
Well, that does it for this edition of Security Wire Weekly. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at certsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page at certsecurity.com/news. From Mike Momoso, I'm Rob Westerveld. Have a great day.